Hey, you are on air.
Hi, this is John Bozeman. I'm one of your United States Senators, and this is a live call, and so it gives us an opportunity for me to talk to you and you to talk to me. So if you'd like to get in line to ask a question or a comment, then just press zero, and that'll get you in the line, and then in a little bit we'll start with the questions. Right now we're waiting for people to get on the line, and so we'll start the question process in just a second. While we do that, I wanted to visit with you just a minute or so about what's going on in Congress right now. We're in the process of trying to confirm President Trump's cabinet, and we've worked hard to get that done and steadily achieving that goal. Today, I was in an agriculture committee hearing, and that had to do with Governor Sonny Perdue, who's going to be the next Secretary of Agriculture, and he's a person that's very, very well qualified. He's going to do a great job. Agriculture doesn't have anything to do with Democrats and Republicans. It's more regional, and the South is different than the I-States, Iowa, Indiana, places like that, and then you've got the Great Plains State, and the key is getting everybody on board and making it such at the end of the day, we've got a good safety net for all of our farmers. We talked about Cuba and the importance of trying to build the market there. Also talked about the summer meals program. Right now, a lot of kids, are in a situation where they simply don't have enough to eat. So we've got a lot of help from our schools and things that feed them during the day. All of a sudden, school gets out. And then, you have the summertime, and there's not an orderly transition to the feeding programs that go in the summer. Got lots of good people that are willing to help out. But the rules that govern that really haven't been changed since the 1960s. And as you know, the world is very, very different than it is now. Last week I had the opportunity to be in Fayetteville and visit with a bunch of veterans and talk about the problems that we're trying to solve there. Talked about the inequality of health care between men and women. We've got over 2 million female veterans now, which is really hard to believe. 20,000 living in Arkansas. And so the VA system has been around for a long time, but it was set up for males because back in the old days, that was the primary, the people that were serving. Now we're in, a different world and have so many more females in the service that do a tremendous job. So myself and Senator Tester introduced a bill, the Deborah Sampson Act, and that goes back to the Revolutionary War, a lady that literally dressed up as a man because she wanted to serve. And in honor of her, introduced a bill that would make it such that it would be much easier for women to get the necessary care that they need at the VA. So here we are, ready to roll. If you'd like to ask a question, punch zero. And we're going to start our question and comment process right now. So we're going to go to our first caller. We don't screen these. These just kind of pop up. And so we'll see what's on the mind of our first caller. Are you there?
Yes, sir, I am.
Yes, sir, go ahead.
My name is Chase Crawford from Pocahontas, Arkansas, up in the Northeast.
Yeah, that's a pretty part of the state.
It is. The reason I'm calling, last time I was on your teletown hall, you made a lot of comments about health care and how, especially reiterated a comment about how one-third of all counties in the United States only have one health care choice.
Right.
And that was a big issue for you, saying that choice was a big deal for the change that y'all wanted to make. But the thing is, none of those counties are in Arkansas. Arkansas, every county in the state has at least three choices, if not four or more, and it's kind of an anomaly versus most states. Most states don't have every single county having two or more at the very least, but we've got three or more in every county. So my question is, what is it that Arkansas has done right to bring so much competition to our state that we could teach other states to do, or cooperate with other states to make their healthcare systems better and more competitive?
Sure.
In the ACA without changing anything?
No, I think that's a good question, and I'll take your word for the more competition in the state of Arkansas. What they did was, they, instead of setting up an exchange, they've taken the money, the Medicaid money that they were getting, and really buy private insurance for those individuals. And that's worked fairly well in Arkansas. Problem is, it's very expensive. They got a waiver to do that. Throughout much of the rest of the country, as we talked about 30% of the counties only have one provider. There's no competition. And in fact, because the system is falling apart, there will be several counties in Tennessee, and probably by this time next year, many more throughout the country, that simply, you have a voucher system, you're entitled to the voucher, you've got coverage, but there's no provider, period. And so that's what's happening to the system nationwide. So Arkansas, has been in a situation doing it the way they did that has staved that off. The trouble is that Arkansas is part of a much larger system. So it's kind of like a patient that's ill, and the rest of it is very ill, but it's creeping outward. And so eventually we're going to be in the same situation, just because the finances, there's nothing in the ACA that controls cost. And there's really nothing in the ACA that controls cost in Arkansas. It's just it's a better deal for providers. And that's why they're providers and insurance companies. That's why in their situation that there is a little bit more competition. But the system as a whole, it really is having tremendous problems. Aetna, one of the major insurers, says it's in a death spiral. The reason being is that premiums are going up. As premiums go up, and again, these high deductibles, less young people, less healthy people don't take it out because they can't afford it. And then as they can't afford it, they get out. Premiums go up even more. More people get out. And that's kind of the situation that we're in. So the Arkansas system is an anomaly. They got a waiver to do it. It's working well. Again, the problem with it is it's even more expensive than the systems in the rest of the country. And and there is inflation, along with that.
So the competition that's in our state, because that's the point that a lot of folks make, is that if there was only more competition, then prices would go down. But you're saying that we have more you're agreeing that we have more competition than most other states, and yet our premiums are higher than other states, even though we have more competition than any other state?
Well, again,
because our premiums didn't rise.
Sure.
Like, I know everybody quotes, like, Arizona went up by however much it was.
Over 100%, yeah.
Over 100%, and then the next state below them was like less than half of that. And then Arkansas, I think, rose 2% last year.
Mm-hmm.
Our premiums, so I mean, that's what I don't understand, is if competition is such a good thing, then why is it that our deductibles and our premiums, like you're saying, are so high? But then if they are so high, why did they only rise 2% in the last year? Why didn't?
Sure.
Why aren't we seeing more numbers like Arizona?
Well, they're higher. They're higher to begin with, and again, this is in the Medicaid and stuff is in the the regular insurance system. So everything has gone up. So it's not only the Medicaid prices are high, but if you look at regular insurance that people buy, people that aren't on the Affordable Care Act. In fact, I was with a company 2 weeks ago, and they were talking about the fact that their premiums had gone up about 20% a year the past 2 or 3 years. And so, they were paying their employees more. But the problem was, you know, their employees weren't getting ahead because invariably that increased cost with their insurance premiums, this is, you know, just regular insurance, it barely kept up with the increase in the premiums. So that's why people aren't feeling like they're getting ahead is, you know, so it really does all go together. But I would argue that regardless, you know, the whole body is, you know, if this were equivalent to a patient, there's lots of disease, so much disease every place else, that the whole system is on the verge of collapsing. And we've got to do something about that with, and again,
sure.
The key to that is affordability. You know, we've got to have access, but we've also got to have affordability.
Well, I agree with that. I'm not one to say that the system has been fixed by the ACA at all. I just, there are parts of it that I see it's worth keeping and parts of it I see, you know, probably
sure.
worth fixing or either fixing or getting rid of. So
sure.
I'm not under any illusion that what system we have right now is perfect. I just make one last quick comment. Last time we were on the town hall, you also mentioned how ACA is going to cause a lot of local hospitals
community
to be
hospitals,
shut down,
yes, sir.
And to close. That is the exact opposite situation with our hospital. I would really appreciate if you had a conversation with the director of the Black River, the Five Rivers Medical Center and the Five
yes,
Rivers
sir.
Hospital in Pocahontas, because they have met with us at Rotary multiple times and other community meetings and said that the ACA has brought their hospital out of the red into the black and on the brink of collapse before the ACA passed, now actually able to profit and make money because of the laws that were changed with the ACA. Now, I can't explain that to you, why
sure.
they're able to actually stay in business and why they're afraid if it gets repealed that they will go out of business, but I would just really ask you to speak with the officials at that hospital in Pocahontas, because they
sure.
they have the exact opposite narrative of that narrative that has been pushed by many in Congress.
No, and I appreciate that, and I really have spoken to them and you know, spoken to so many community hospitals all throughout Arkansas and will continue to do so. I think what they'll tell you, though, is right now, you know, things are profitable, you know, and they're able to make it. The problem is that you have to pay for this somehow. And with the Medicare cuts, the decline in reimbursement that are programmed in over the next 10 years, that's where it gets really, really troublesome. So right now, you know, they're rocking along. But again, at some point, you got to figure out how to pay for this. And the only way you can do that is through consolidation, like with schools. You know, we saw a lot of school consolidation in Arkansas that cuts cost. And through rationing. We're seeing it through rationing in the sense that more and more doctors, you know, we talk about Medicare and Medicaid, you know, those being programs that help people, but more and more doctors, more and more providers simply aren't taking those anymore. And so, you know, you can have this great program, but if nobody will accept it because the federal government doesn't pay you enough, you know, to really make it on it, then it gets pretty tough. But I think that's the difference is, you know, if you look over the next 10 years, things get pretty tough. The Congressional Budget Office, not me, you know, says that the community hospitals throughout the country, and you know, it's great that your local hospital is doing well, because that's so, so very important. You know, you lose your community hospital, that's the best paying jobs in town. That's what people look at when they're talking about putting a business in or relocating, retiring. So we really do need to protect that. But no, I'll be glad to, and as you see those guys, tell them that I appreciate their hard work, and we really will help them any way we can. And you say, well, John, you know, it's not going to happen. But if you look at the federal programs that we have right now, and that's really what you know, the ACA, Obamacare is really trying to do, is federalize these things. You know, if you're a veteran, you travel, and you know, we've got two really good hospitals in Arkansas trying to take care of veterans and done a pretty good job of it. But, you know, if you live someplace else outside of Little Rock or Fayetteville, then again, you travel. And the same is true of Indian Health Care also. That's the other federal program for hospitals. But thank you so much for calling, and I will take your advice and follow up. And, again,
sure.
You're blessed. You know, these guys are doing a great job. And the key is,
Senator,
we want to be
healthy
really now,
do.
But we want to be healthy, you know, 10 years from now also.
Yeah, I do want to say I appreciate you, and thank you for taking my call.
No, thank you for calling. You got great questions, great comments. So appreciate
right.
you. Thank you, sir. Okay, let's go to our next caller. And again, if you'd like to get in line and ask a question or a comment, just punch 0, and we'll go from there. Okay, are you there?
Yes, Senator
yes, ma'am.
Bozeman. This is Alain Bonham in Russellville, Arkansas, and thank you so much for taking time to listen to your constituents and find out some information. You've always been a good listener, and I appreciate that about you. I'm watching on the different various television stations, and
uh-huh.
right now Congress is trying to decide what to do with the Affordable Care Act. And I just wanted to ask you, why the hurry? I mean, I know what you said, in 10 years we're going to have a real problem, but I'm just afraid that they're piecemealing some proposals, and the American people do not even know what those proposals are. And I'm just thinking that, you know, in any good plan, the implementation is one thing, but the actual design and the modification, or even if it's repeal and replace, to plan that out with a lot of hospitals, a lot of stakeholders at the table, to me seems like a better strategy than people who are not in the healthcare business trying to make a decision about where to go. Because without all the stakeholders involved in that discussion, I fear we're just going to end up with another situation that's unsustainable. And so I'm asking you, sir, what is your vote going to be on the Affordable Care Act that they're proposing right now? And I do know you're in the Senate, and yours is not there yet, but the House is working on it. But would you support the plan that they're hastily throwing together tonight?
Well, I agree with you totally in the sense that I also don't understand the rush. This is 18% of our economy. This is talking about really health care for all of us, because the Affordable Care Act and helping those in need, it really does affect our whole insurance system. And so it's very, very important that we do it right. So I don't disagree with you at all. In fact, yeah, I hear people, tell me that, basically we've got to do something. I'm hearing that now. I heard it when the Affordable Care Act went into place. And my answer to that is, we've got to do the right thing. And that's really what you're saying. So the House is trying to, come up with something. I don't, as you mentioned, I'm in the Senate, so I won't be voting on that. I know that as it, as they get it out of the House eventually, I don't know if they're going to have the votes to do this now or not, but if they do, it'll come over to the Senate, and it will be, subject to a lot of amendment. And then the Senate works a lot slower than the House. And so, like I say, a lot of amendments, and then we'll see what we're left with. So I don't know if I'm going to be able to support the final bill or not, because we really don't know what the final bill is as we go forward. The one thing, though, that we have to do and is affordability. And I don't know that there's really enough in this bill right now to control cost. And that really is a key. We've got to make it such that as I was talking with the other caller, and he had some great questions and comments, you simply can't go forward, with these very, very high premiums increasing every year with $3,000, $4,000, $5,000, $10,000 deductibles for the average Arkansan. And then after that, after you meet all of that, maybe an 80-20 match where you still have to pay 20%, and then they kick in and pay 80%. So you've got so much money into it that, for the average hardworking Arkansan, you know, you're talking a situation where that's not insurance, that's catastrophic insurance. And that's very, very common. You know, it doesn't matter, you know, if you're a teacher or a welder or a, you know, I'm an optometrist and eye doctor by training, so, I really am experienced in these things. But we had, we probably had about 70 employees at the clinic when I was there many years ago, and our highest cost of doing business was payroll, and then right after that was our health insurance cost, and that was several years ago. You know, that was 16 years ago. Those costs now have skyrocketed, so we have to make it affordable, and right now I don't really see that there's enough safeguards to actually do that.
And I really appreciate you saying that, because I do work in education, and I see even teachers struggling,
yeah.
you know, with the cost, which they may not be on the exchange or anything, but you're right, it does affect
just your basic insurance.
Yes. I would like to.
And you're, let me just say one other thing about that. You know, you're in a huge buying group, you know, so theoretically you should be getting, you know, a good deal because you're with so many others. You can imagine what the insurance cost is for my barber, you know, with maybe a couple employees. And then two, if you're self-employed, you don't get to deduct it. So it really is. It's just something that we need to fix.
We need to change that. Yes,
yes,
we do, sir. I would like to recommend that we do call in Big Pharma, and we call in Hospital Association and the Doctors Association, and we truly get everyone in to say we're all in this together and, you know, and get some experts in there to work on this. And do it right this time, because I'll tell you another thing that costs a lot is when you have to have your accountants change everything that they know how to do on one system and change over to another system. And I'm all about making it affordable and revising the health care plan. I do think we need to consider that health is a right that people should be able to, if they work, and if they do their best, that they should be able to go to the doctor and take their children to the doctor. But I think we're going to have to get everyone there and get everyone. And I just want to ask you to please ask your colleagues to slow down and do it right this time.
No, I think you give good advice. And, you know, you mentioned pre-existing conditions. You know, certainly it shouldn't be that, you know, you're in a situation now where you have insurance as a teacher and then you move to another job and, you know, you change jobs, you lose your insurance, and then maybe if you're diabetic, you know, something like that, then, you know, you're uninsurable at that point. So that's very important. Portability, you know, being able to move. You know, I've had the same car insurance since I was 16 years old, but I've had numerous different, you know, types of health insurance as I have, you know, moved from different jobs, different situations. So portability is good. This thing of allowing young people to be on their policies with their parents, you know, till they're 26, that's been very, very helpful. And really hasn't cost a whole lot of money. So those are the kind of things, you know, that we need to learn from and you know, continue on. It shouldn't be also that you pay your insurance your whole life and then you get really sick and you hit a cap in your insurance and then they say, see you later, you know, and then you're not insured at that point. So these are all things that really are very, very important. And I think you give us good advice in the sense of, you know, let's work through these things and get something done that's, you know, going to be the right thing.
And I do appreciate the Senate for taking your time. Thank you very much.
What do you teach?
Well, actually, I'm an assistant superintendent. I did teach for 10 years in Arkansas.
You're one of the big dogs.
Well,
I appreciate you. I was on the school board for 7 years, and I understand how hard you guys work, and you know, really do appreciate you and your colleagues the principals, the teachers, and then all of the ancillary people that make the schools work. It's a big deal. And so thank you so much for doing that. That's great.
Thank you, sir.
Yes, ma'am. Okay. Thank you. And let's go to our next caller. And again, if you'd like to comment or ask a question, really about anything you'd like to, whether it's a local problem or this or that problem, you're welcome to do that. Just punch 0 and that'll get you on the line. Are you there? Go
Hello,
ahead.
Hello, Senator.
Yes,
my name
sir.
Is Woody Gillespie. I live in Drumming
Woody.
Shoals, Arkansas. I think I've talked to you before. The lady from Russellville and you pretty well answered my question that I had on the front end about the ACA, and I petition all 3 of you not to vote for what we've got, what we're looking at right now. I think this is a piecemeal thing that Paul Ryan put together, and I don't think it's worth the paper it's written on. So I ask all 3 of you that, you know, not to endorse it, even though I hated to see Trump lose on it, but that's just the way it is. My question that I had was, I'm with the VA, and I had been going to Memphis for ages, and I've just changed over to Little Rock. I live about 75 miles from Little Rock, and I have transferred to Searcy, but all they have is a GP there. They have no eye clinics or anything else like that.
Right.
And I'm, you know, this white card that we got, which was supposed to take care of everything for us guys that didn't live, that live too far away.
Yes, sir.
That does not work. Or for me, at least, it does not work, or has not. Every time I needed something, I would call them and they'd say, oh, no, you're not covered for that. You'll have to go to the regular VA. And they hang up, and that's it. There's no explanation of why or anything else about it. And I'm getting at the age now that I don't like to drive. My eyes are getting bad, and I need some surgeries for cataracts and stuff.
Sure.
And I'm just wondering, what do I need to do? Just have to get some help and go on to the main hospital, or can I find someone that I would trust or want to
well,
do this
here's
and
what,
go there?
I'm
or
sorry.
What?
Okay.
Go ahead.
Here's what you need to do. Let me tell you. First of all, I understand the what you're referring to is what we call the Choice Act, and
yes.
That allows you know if you live you know so many miles away and you know it's helped somewhat. But what we're trying to do is really expand that so that a person like you, you know, that's kind of in between in distances, and we certainly don't want to get ourselves in a situation where you know. All the insurance is like that, and that's what I was talking about earlier. But
sure.
But you're in a situation, you know, where you've got distances to travel to go to a VA hospital, and so
well,
we're trying to.
Interrupting, but I'm also single, so I don't have with where I live. There's no kin folks or anything around.
Yeah,
so
yeah, no, it makes it,
on it myself.
Sure. No, exactly, and that makes it you know that makes it really difficult. So what we're trying to do is expand the Choice Act so that it's much more easier for people like yourself, you know, that live away to actually go ahead and get the services that you need, you know, that aren't there with the, you know, like in Searcy, you know, they don't have all the specialists that you need there to allow you to go ahead and get that done at the private sector. So we're working on that. You know, it's going to get better. In the meantime, what I want you to do is call our Little Rock office and ask for Anita. And you got a pencil so I can give you a number?
I have.
Okay.
Anita, I've got it down.
Okay. Call the Little Rock office, Anita, 501-372-7153. So 501-372-7153. And just explain your situation, then we'll be glad to ask a question why, you know, you can't participate now and see if we can work through that for you.
Okay. good enough.
And,
Thank you, sir.
Get a good answer. And then that, too, will help us, hopefully we can work through that where you'll be able to get more care locally. But also it helps us, figure out what gaps we need to plug with a person like you, to make this thing a lot better.
Yeah, well, I've been in the medical field most of my life, but there's some things that just, you can't get around. It's their policies,
no.
And this is the way it goes.
Yep.
And I
understand.
You have to learn the system.
And, like you say, needing eye surgery with your cataract and stuff, that's, and being by yourself, I mean, that's difficult to navigate,
sure
getting back and forth, especially, early on with just, one eye that's operating, quite as well as it ought to. So, but I do appreciate that. Give her a call and we'll go from there, okay?
Okay, Senator. Thank you for your help.
No, thank you so much for calling. Very good. Okay, let's go to our next person in line. Again, if you'd like to get in line, punch zero and we'll go from there. That was really a good question. What we're trying to do is work really hard to make it such that our veterans, who, again, these are not things we're giving them. These are earned benefits, allowing our veterans to get their care when they live, pretty far from a VA hospital, to allow them to get that care locally. And the good news is that we're moving in the right direction in that regard. Okay, let's go to our next caller. Are you there? Go ahead.
Yes, I'm here. Senator, thank you very much for having the call, and I want to thank your staffers in D.C. also. They've been very nice and kind all the different times I've called them. So thank you for wanting to hear from us. I do have a question about when we reform healthcare, what is your position on some of the mandatory kinds of coverages? My understanding is that before the Affordable Care Act, it was really hard for people with mental health conditions and with substance abuse problems to get those treatments covered, especially people who have kind of chronic conditions that they have to keep going back multiple times. And it seems like right now it's a little bit of a better situation because there is more parity between mental and physical health. I'm wondering if that's something that you're going to be concerned about when you're making a decision on voting for the next proposal.
No, I am very concerned about it. We've got lots of, traditional mental health problems, but along with that, we've got a drug epidemic with the opioids, people needing treatment in that regard. And so, mental health is very, very important. Sadly, a lot of the people in our jails now, our county jails, have mental illness. A lot of our homeless, are mentally ill. So this is something that we have to work for. Now, the trade-off is that, the more things that you include, that's really what drives cost. And so we've got to figure out, how to make these things affordable. And you can get all the bells and whistles with your car insurance, or you can get just a basic policy that's much less expensive. So mental health's important. Drug treatment is very, very important these days, with the epidemic that we've got going on with the opioids. It's rapidly moving to heroin. The leading cause of accidental death in young people now is drug overdose. They'll, mix a pill with alcohol and just simply lay down and not wake up because it slows your heart rate. I want to say that drug deaths are have overcome car deaths right now. So these are very, very serious problems. So it's just something that we've got to work through. And I would advocate, like the lady that called from Russellville, advocated slowing down. Look at these things and make sure that reach some middle ground to make it such that you can get these things done. And yet we can't continue to have 20% increases, with regular health care. We're going to spend over the next 10 years, counting the what we've already spent, close to $2 trillion, and maybe have insured an extra 5%. we can do better than that. Yeah. So that's the real challenge, is affordability, and again, it's a difficult goal to reach.
Right. You know, I like the metaphor that that you and a lot of people have been using with car insurance, and how you as a consumer get to make some choices about whether you want the bare bones or the bells and whistles. You know, but with car insurance, I never think I need collision insurance because I'm a really good driver. I'm not going to get an accident. But
sure.
So I would choose to not opt for that. But then that's a problem when I hit someone else. And I think with mental health and substance abuse, no one thinks that they're going to need that. No one thinks that their son's going to be a heroin addict. And so I'm wondering if you could make a commitment that mental health and substance abuse will have to be represented in anything that you sign.
Yeah. Well, again, I don't know, I can't tell you exactly what it's all going to look like because it's going to be a package. But I do know this, that the system that we're under right now is simply not working. So it's great, if we offer all of these things, if nobody can afford it, it doesn't work. So I will work strongly to include those kind of things. I don't know, the extent that it's going to wind up, but I do know it's very, very important. And I think it's something that we as a state need to identify. And all of this stuff can't be done by the federal government, mandating and things. This, as a state, as a nation, but particularly as a state, we have to take mental health, I think, a little bit more serious in the sense that it's even now, with the situation we're at, with these mandates and things, it's very, very lacking. And so it's a huge problem, as and they're advocating.
Well, thank you for your consideration. I appreciate it.
No, and thank you again. Thank you for a very thoughtful call. And these are real problems that we simply have to work through. And but it is very, very important. So thank you a bunch. Appreciate it. Okay, let's go to our next caller. And again, if you'd like to be. As you can see, we've really had some just really good comments and questions tonight. If you'd like to get in line, punch zero, and we'll go from there. We're going to go to our next caller now.
Thank you, Mr. Bozeman.
Yes, ma'am.
I have some concerns over your confirmations that you voted in. Betsy DeVos, who has never been in a public school, who had never taught in a public school, who had never been an administrator in a public school, what made you think that she would be good for that position?
I think she's going to do a great job. I think she's committed to allowing the opportunity to have local control, to get more power back to the states, as opposed to having a federal school board in Washington. Which is what we had, in the last administration. So the implementation of the rewrite of the No Child Left Behind Act that we did in a very bipartisan way in the last Congress was the biggest turn back in power in the last 25 years. But the Education Department has started writing those rules.
That was Mr. Bush's. No Child Left Behind.
I'm talking about it was, and what we did in the last Congress was we revised it. There were some good things in it, and there were some really bad things. And so we worked hard, working together, and rewrote it and came up with something that is going to be good and really does. It's the biggest turn back in power to the states in the last 25 years. The key is implementing it in the way that we wrote it. And she's going
to
do that.
But I understand that she wants to do the charter schools. And what that, and if she wants to do the charter schools only and leave public schools out, that's wrong.
Yeah, I agree with that totally. I was on the school board. Let me finish. I was on the school board for 7 years, public school board. All of my daughters went to public school. I grew up in Fort Smith. I went to Darby Junior High, Peabody Elementary, and Northside High School. Those are all very working class schools. So I believe very, very strongly in public schools. There are some public schools that simply aren't working. We have some public schools here in Washington, D.C., where I'm at right now, that they send more kids to the penitentiary than they do to college. That's not an exaggeration. Spending about $18,000 a year, which is probably three times what we spend in Arkansas, those parents need choice.
When we went into segregation or out of segregation in the early 60s in Arkansas, I taught in Elaine, Arkansas. The white parents moved their kids to academies, which are basically charter schools, and left the poor black and poor white students in the public schools. There was no chance for them. And if you look, Elaine has been consolidated because it couldn't cut it. And I just don't want to see that happen to our schools.
No, I agree with you totally. And like I say, Betsy DeVos didn't do that. That was done a long time ago, and we're getting out of that situation. What we're doing is demanding that places like that, schools where, it's the attitude that you're doing pretty good considering where you came from, those kind of attitudes from teachers, that simply doesn't cut it. That's dead wrong. And
yes.
So right now we have a situation where we have a lot of charter schools within the public schools themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And those were very much feared, when I was on the school board several years ago. But those have turned into great opportunities for young people that just have different interests. So that's what we need. That's the direction that we need to go to. But don't misunderstand. Like I say, I'm very, very much in favor and have lived, being a great advocate for public schools, and will continue to do that. So, if I see any move in the direction that's not going to be the case, then I'll be yelling the loudest. But I haven't seen any evidence, from her doing that right now. Again, local control is so important. Getting ourselves in a situation where the state, our local school boards, that really is the best situation.
And as far as health care goes, Mr. Bozeman, what kind of health care do you have in the Senate?
Well, in the Senate, it's interesting. I worked really hard. I very much opposed, the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, because there was nothing to control cost. I'm an optometrist and eye doctor, and I saw that coming.
Well,
and
I
so
was a nurse.
Ma'am?
I was a nurse.
Good. Well, again, and you understand that too then. So what I did and several others said was basically, look, if it's good enough for the American public, it's good enough for Congress.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm on the Affordable Care Act right now, as is my staff. So, yeah.
Okay. That's what I wanted to know. Because,
yes, ma'am.
See, the Affordable Care Act has been working for me. And I hate to see it cut to pieces just so Mr. Trump can say, well, look what I did. This is ridiculous. His changes.
Yes, ma'am. The trouble, though, as you know, is that if you visit with some of your friends that aren't on the Affordable Care Act, or there isn't a situation where they're on it and they don't get the vouchers and they don't get the support, they're a little bit above that line, they're paying through the nose. And people on private insurance now are we're looking at significant increases every year. $5,000-$10,000 deductibles are not uncommon at all. And you simply can't do that. So you work hard, you get a little raise, and invariably it's eaten up by an increase in the in your health insurance premium. So we need to do a good job. The other problem is that with Medicare and Medicaid, traditional Medicaid and Medicare, a lot of providers simply aren't taking it anymore. And so, you've got a Medicaid program, and that's great. But if nobody will see you because, we don't pay enough that it makes a difference, that's not a good situation. Seeing the same thing with Medicare right now. People are starting to either not take new patients or they limit the amount of patients that they see.
Well, they always have. But the other thing, I would really like to see an investigation into the White House about the Russia thing, the Russia connection.
Yes, ma'am. I think there's several going on right now.
Well, I want a special prosecutor put in place, just like they did to Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton and everybody else. I mean, what's good for the goose is good for the gander, right?
Sure.
And
we should investigate him as
vigorously as they investigated Hillary.
Sure. Let's see what comes out. If you've been watching the news, the Republicans
have
been pretty hard on this thing. And
I hope you'll stay hard. I don't want to see him roll over everybody to get his point of view across.
Sure. But, again, like I said, there's the Oversight Committee, and then you've got the Intelligence Committees that are working hard to try and figure out what's gone on. The idea of us, the Russian interference is not a good situation at all. We've got to see, what went there. But as far as there being any evidence up to now, and this has been repeatedly said, that President Trump was not coordinating. The election wasn't stolen in that regard, and there was no stealing of votes or anything like that.
Well, Trump said there were 3 million people that voted illegally, and he's repeated it several times.
No, I think he was concerned about illegal immigration, but a lot of that stuff, people have disputed, and Republicans along with Democrats, so that's a good thing.
Well, I thank you for listening.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you so much for calling. Really do appreciate it. Okay, let's go to our next caller, and again, really good calls tonight. Lots of thoughtful people.
Senator Bush.
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Yes, I wanted to ask a question about immigration.
Yes.
Okay, it seems like they're really backed up on legal immigration, and now there's actually something from Senator Cotton that's saying that he wants to reduce it to 50,000 per year, and yet they're still working on, I think, 2013 or way back. There are people here that would probably just love to have somebody immigrate here legally, and that would be a plus for the American economy.
Right. What Senator Cotton was referring to with the 50,000, that was with refugees. And so that's people like from Syria, these war-torn countries, allowing them to come over. And when you look over about the last 10 years, 50,000 is the average. President Obama, as he was leaving office the last year or so, he pushed that up to over 100,000. And so what Senator Cotton's doing is just trying to get back to the average. But let me tell you about this in the sense that we really can be very proud as a nation. I mean, we have lots of folks coming here legally. We naturalize. In other words, we make citizens of about 1 million people a year. We make citizens of more people as a nation than almost the rest of the world put together.
No, sir. I'm in Siloam Springs. I'm George Grimm. I helped to tutor naturalization. But the thing is there are so many people on the waiting list.
There's 5 million. There's 5 million on the waiting list.
Yes, sir. That's what
and like
saying.
I say, we naturalize 1 million every year, which again is when you compare that to other countries, we naturalize 1 million people, which is almost as much as the entire world naturalizes in their countries.
I understand that, sir. But the thing
so
is, those people
there
are
is a limit. There is a limit to how many we can
take.
There are
out there, especially Latin Americans, that would love to come here.
All of Mexico would, yes, sir.
Economy.
No, all of Mexico would love to come here, and all of Guatemala, and you know, all of Venezuela, and the list goes on and on. But the reality is we're a nation of laws. You have to do this where you can actually assimilate the people, and we've really done a good job of doing that. But we're talking a lot tonight about various benefits that people have under our system. We're really struggling to meet those benefits with our current population. But allowing people to come across the border with probably on average about a sixth grade education, that's you get yourself in a situation there where you've got all of these people that are trying to do it legally. And again, it's like, you know, being at McDonald's and somebody just coming up to the front of the line. I mean, it's simply not fair. And we need to naturalize the people that you know, we feel like are going to be a benefit and contribute to the country.
Yes, sir, I understand that. Yeah, but I know there's something goes on about the, you know, that they can come here and actually support themselves, that they may have some education and things like that. I understand all that, but there are people that would love to come here that do have these type of merits to their cases.
Yes, sir.
But it seems like it goes back so many years.
No, it's difficult. Like I say, we're blessed. We're a nation that lots of people would like to come and be a part of. We do a great job of assimilating people, we've got our problems, but again, we really do a good job of that. We've got 5 million people in line, and we're trying to work through that. It is, but again, adding 1 million a year is a lot also. So there is a limit, and we've decided, that is the limit. And so at some point you have to say that's the number that we can assimilate. That's what's best for the country. And then people get in line, and those 5 million, sometimes it takes, 5-10 years to do. It sounds like you've been to naturalization ceremonies and things, and, those are very moving.
Yep,
they're, very emotional. People are giving up their citizenship, and those are really great things. They're so proud to become American citizens.
Oh,
I've done it right.
Proud.
Yeah. So,
pride,
right,
among the community, especially,
right,
the Hispanic community and the Latin community and things that come in here.
Sure.
But they just don't understand why, if they want to bring their brother or somebody that has a great education already, and they find it almost impossible because there's a waiting list of, what did you say, 8 years, 10 years?
Yeah, 5 million people.
Yes.
Yeah.
It seems like an awful lot. It seems like,
No,
but
I understand,
anyway.
I
appreciate that.
No, very much. And again, the other side of that is that, there is a limit that we can absorb in a good way. What we'd like is those people, as they come to, one of the things as you go through the citizenship program is learning English and learning about our system of democracy and things like that. So you have to do it in an orderly way. But, that's kind of where we're at. Thank you very much. I do appreciate your call.
Thank you. And you're doing a great job with the veterans. Thank you very again.
Oh, thank you. Nobody's more deserving. So thank you, sir. Let's go to our next caller. Really had a variety of different issues and really just a lot of thoughtful people that are calling in tonight and talking about things that are on their mind. Let's go to our next caller. Are you there? Go ahead. Okay, that one's not on there. Let's go to another one. Are you there?
Hi. How are you?
Yes, sir. Great.
Hey, my name is Corey Wright. I'm a software developer in Jonesboro, Arkansas.
Yeah.
And I had a question to ask. I'm really, really big on net neutrality and, start our rights as the world goes into the electronic age and everything's kind of changing. And I was calling in reference to Senate Joint Resolution 34 that you voted in favor of today, which it seems like, as far as I can tell, the only intent of that bill was to, just kind of counteract a bill that was passed by the FCC that protects our rights as consumers. And so basically the effect of this bill was that internet service providers can now sell our information to, you know, companies to make an extra buck, I assume. I was wondering what about that you think is good for the people, and just a little bit more information on why you voted in favor of that bill today.
Well, to be honest, I'd have to look at what's going on with the bill.
I would assume if you voted in favor of it that you were familiar with the text of the bill. It's very short. It's less than a page. It was Senate Joint Resolution 34.
Okay. So tell me again what it does.
Here, let me pull it up. I've got it on my computer here.
Sure.
It says, resolved by the Senate and House of Representatives of the United States of America and Congress assembled, that Congress disapproves the rule submitted by the FCC relating to this is the name of the law, protecting the privacy of customers of broadband and other telecommunication services. And such rule shall have no force or effect. That's the entirety of the bill text, actually.
Right. Really, the main thrust of it was net neutrality. And one of the problems with net neutrality is the fact that you had the FCC, which is an agency of the government set up to do some decision making, but with something like net neutrality, which I think you'd agree really is a big deal. Those are the kind of things that really need to be decided by Congress. People that have been elected, people that come up here and have some accountability back home, rather than the FCC or the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, having the ability to do those kind of things. Does that make sense?
I understand what you're saying. But
I think we could have gotten
overarching. It's like an overarching governmental solution. So it affects all of the states, basically allowing internet service providers in any state to look at my history or your history, internet history, and sell it to someone, make a profit off of it. I'm just curious as to what is beneficial to that for us, for we the people, And
sure.
Also, I don't know. I was wondering if maybe. Well, I'll just go ahead. What is good about that for us, Arkansans in specific?
Well, I think again the problem is that it is a privacy issue, and the people that need to be able to determine the role of privacy issues is Congress versus the FCC.
Right. So you're basically
saying they have
to sell our information.
No,
you
I'm
made
saying,
that decision today.
Well, I'm saying let's get rid of the situation that we're in, and then Congress needs to get to work and come up with a rule. Where you can talk to me about it versus the FCC, where it's impossible to talk to a commissioner or whatever. They simply don't have that authority to do that. It's
well,
overreach.
They did this essentially
as the last administration was going out. They did all kinds of these things that, they simply didn't have the authority to do it.
Electronic age, so it's kind of at the time that things start happening. So that's why it's been happening recently, when net neutrality is only like a recent issue. But second question, follow-up kind of. I noticed that a lot of your campaign contributions, about $40,000 to $50,000, come from telecommunications companies who are actually the ones that stand to gain from this. The people do not gain at all from what you've done today, but the companies do quite a bit. They'll probably make millions and millions of dollars off of selling this information about our private, private matters. Do you think that had any sway on your decision today?
No, in fact, the You know, that's I really don't look at those things. You know, what I do is do the best I can do. And people don't support me to change my mind. People support me because they know the direction I'm going. And, you know, the direction I'm going is that, you know, I would like to limit the FCC's authority, you know, and talk these things about these things in a Congress, you know, passing laws that are such that, you know, there's somebody with some accountability getting it done in that way. And so,
tell me if I'm getting this wrong. Tell me if I'm getting this wrong. So goal number one is to take out the FCC and all these federal, you know, organizations that have some kind of power. And goal number two is to then do something about it. So, you know, these things take a long time. So what happens in the interim? What happens after you've taken out all of the, you know, the group of guidelines and the rules that everybody has to follow? You take out the FCC, you take out the, you know, I don't know what else.
No, I don't think anybody's suggesting that. These agencies are all set up, you know, these agencies are set up by Congress. They didn't just come.
Yeah.
The executive branch didn't set them up. They were set up by Congress, and then they're administered to a large degree by the executive branch. When they're set up, they're given by statute what they can do and what they can't do. And they've got pretty wide latitude. But when they exceed that latitude, that's not the right situation. And so,
You think the Customer Protection Act was contrary to the people's well-being, or is that what I'm getting? Or do you just think that decision should be locally held?
I think that the FCC, the EPA, the SEC, all of the entities that you mentioned need to stick within the guidelines as to what they have the authority to do. And if it exceeds those guidelines, then those are areas that Congress needs to act, whether it's beneficial or not. You know, again, they've got their authority. Congress has their authority. The president has his authority or her authority, and that's how our system works. We're a nation of laws, and that's how you do things in an orderly way.
So you think they should not? So you think companies should have the right to sell our private information, just like you allowed them to do today? Is that correct?
I think that.
Because remember, you voted on it. You voted for this. You and
no,
Bill
no,
Cotton
I did for sure.
About 48 other senators that were Republican. I think there were no Democrats, and two Republicans abstained.
Right, right. No, I voted for it and stand behind it. Sure. But it has to do with, you know, the underlying reasoning used to approve the rule was that the FCC should have a larger role in our privacy issues. I don't believe that's the case.
So is that high on your priority list?
It's very high on my list in the sense that right now we have a situation where all kinds of cyber things, whether it's cybersecurity, whether it's I'm a co-chair of the Broadband Caucus, you know, trying to get these things out in communities so that our smaller communities can compete in all kinds of different ways with businesses and things like that. So the protection, just the whole system, you know, is so, so very important. But it does need to be done in the right way. And it shouldn't be done by the FCC deciding, you know, all of these things. It needs to be done by Congress. The good news is that there really is a willingness to work through these things and to do it the right way. It needs to go through the committees of jurisdiction, and then it needs to go before the full House and the full Senate. That's how you get things done, and at the end of the day, come up with a good product. But I think that we had a situation where Chairman Wheeler, you know, really did overreach a great deal on many different occasions. And that's how we've gotten ourselves, you know, in this situation. But I do appreciate your call.
It's not, it's, Yeah.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
No, thank you so much for calling. And let's go to our next caller. But the things that he brings up really are really important. You know, the privacy issues, all of these things. These are things that we need to work through. We also need to work through, as I said, the fact that so many areas of Arkansas, it's really difficult to have the broadband that we need. How do you have the schools systems that you need and the small businesses and stuff to compete if you don't have good broadband access? And then along with that, as you do that, then you need cybersecurity. You know, we need to be protected from people stealing our stuff, whether it's a credit card or business information and all of these kind of things. But I do feel very strongly that that the agencies, the FCC under Chairman Wheeler, had a tendency to overdo. And it's okay, you know, if an agency overdoes and you happen to agree with it, then it's okay. But if it, you know, if you have another situation, a different president, and the agency overreaches, you know, and it's not in your favor, that's not right. You know, it's so Congress is the one that needs to handle these things, not somebody that's unelected, and then the commissioners unelected that simply have free rein to do these things. So let's go to our next caller. Are you there?
Hello, this is Jack from Newton County. Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Great.
Good. In 1970, a Republican president established the Environmental Protection Agency. And the reason that was done is because there was a plethora of confusing and ineffective laws concerning the protection of our water, our air. We even had a river in the northern part of the U.S. that caught on fire. And in order to consolidate this, to make it sensible, to make it easy for corporations and companies to work with this, it was decided that the Environmental Protection Agency's job was to establish rules and guidelines. And this has done a tremendous job in improving our quality of our air and our water. Although I must say, as a person who's now in my 70s, I can remember a time walking with my grandfather as a child, and we got thirsty, and we cupped our hands and we drank out of a stream. Nobody would think of doing that today in almost any stream in the United States. So I think that the problem is that there is not enough regulation on these critical issues of air and water and soil protection. And I'm a little tired of hearing the overused overreach when it's the experts in the Environmental Protection Agency, when the Federal Communications Commission, these are people that are the authorities. And I'm very concerned about Pruitt having been approved for that position when it's well known that he has been a critic of EPA for a long, long time and has even stated that he would like to eliminate it. So I'm very concerned that this is allowed to happen. And I can understand that there are some regulations that are onerous and need to be changed, but this drumbeat of anti-regulation, I would like to hear from Congress some of the information about how much good the Environmental Protection Agency has done and is continuing to do.
No, the as you mentioned, you know, the EPA was formed by President Nixon, you know, back in the 70s. And we can be very, very proud of the things that have happened as a result. The EPA has produced regulation. As I mentioned with the last caller, the EPA was set up and it had certain authorities that it could do. And it needs to stay within that authority. Constitutionally, the waters in the United States are regulated by the states. the states have the authority to do that unless they're navigable. And the Supreme Court has ruled on several occasions, to that effect. Then they said, if it drains in and stuff, if there's a nexus to the waters, then we'll even allow that. But the EPA, under the Obama administration, ruled basically that all of the waters in the U.S. were under federal jurisdiction. And so because of that, if you needed to get a permit or whatever, then you'd have to do that from the federal government. That was a tremendous overreach. What happened was that the federal court system has put it on hold and said, hey, you simply can't do that. The same is true of the Clean Air Act. We can, we're blessed. We've done a great job of, mitigating some of the problems that we've had. But the Clean Air Act that the Obama administration put out was a clear overreach. The courts have put that on hold, and so as a result, that's not in effect right now because it was unconstitutional, because they simply didn't have the authority. I agree with you. We need regulation. It needs to be based on sound science, and it needs to fall within the purview of the agency as set up by law. The danger is that if you don't do that, then right now, Scott Pruitt is the head of the EPA. You don't want a situation where whoever the head is has complete authority. Scott Pruitt needs to work under the authority of the laws as they were set up back in the 70s and then amended over the years, by Congress. If not, then, whoever's in charge of the agency at the time is the king, and that just simply doesn't work. We're a nation of laws. The agencies need to be able to legislate, or not legislate, do rulemaking process based on the statute that they're under. And here lately, we've been in a situation where they simply haven't had the authority to do what they've done. And they've gotten themselves in trouble, and so the courts have put them in hold. And what I'm going to be doing with Scott Pruitt is making sure that he uses the authority that he has no more, and also working very, very hard with our states, with the federal government, to ensure that we continue on the path that we've been.
I appreciate
cleaning the environment up and using sound science, science that is such that everybody can look at it. You don't do these things in the back door and then not refuse to release the science that all this is based on. That's the right way of doing it.
I appreciate the fact that you have mentioned two very specific things. I don't happen to agree with you on the air and water issue, the Clean Water Plan and so forth, but I appreciate the fact that you have been specific. And this has been one of my problems over the last several years, is that it's just been a drumbeat of anti-regulation. It was never specific, and I don't know if it's because people think the public are morons and can't handle the specifics, but if the conversation had been around, this is a specific regulation that needs to be changed, and here's why, rather than this general anti-regulation that EPA is the enemy of progress when the reverse is true. That's what gets to me. And the fact that you all allowed an unqualified anti-EPA person to take charge of that agency is unconscionable.
Well, let's wait and see what he does. He has sued the EPA on a number of different occasions, but I think he's won most of those. Because you did have a situation where they overreached, so you've got to, and it's not just Oklahoma. It's many, many states throughout the country, and so these things need to be done in such a way that they are within the boundaries of the law, and you've got to get the states buying into it. You can't have all of these unfunded mandates where you just dump stuff on them. I'll give you a good example. The here in Washington, D.C., the gentleman that runs the all the sewage treatment plant, essentially, you know, they've had all kinds of problems for decades. And so the EPA said, clean it up. And they did this under their authority, okay? So they did the right thing. And this area has spent $1 billion doing that. And we're in a situation now where the Potomac has fish in it again and all of these kind of things, and this is great. What they did next was they came back and said, you've got to ratchet down even lower and to a point that technologically it's really questionable as to whether or not they could even do it. That would cost them another $1 billion, and everybody, and again, you know, this is a situation where this is a very Democratic area and things. I mean, it didn't have anything to do with Democrats or Republicans, but the EPA came down and said, you've got to ratchet down even more and spend another $1 billion, as much as they did for the other. And, you know, nobody could say that the end result was going to make it such that the river would be any cleaner as a result of doing that. That's crazy. I mean, you know, that's just regulation for regulation's sake. So we've got to have some common sense. We've got to use sound science to get these things done. But we can be very, very proud, as you mentioned, of the fact that we have made, you know, great gains and need to continue doing that, you know, for sure. Lots of work with our farmers, you know, through the Farm Bill with conservation mm-hmm. programs and things. These are all great steps in the right direction.
I appreciate that. Would you be, at some point, be willing to go on the Senate floor and make a speech in favor of the EPA minus these overreach items that you're talking about, so that we just don't constantly hear this drum anti-EPA thing, so that people have gotten the impression that it is some kind of evil empire there, when in fact it's done a tremendous amount of good? I'd just like to hear that spoken.
No, I'll be glad to do that. In fact, I will. I actually do that in committee all the time, and we're going to have a hearing. I'm actually the chair of the Water Subcommittee on Environment and Public Works, and we're going to have a hearing sometime next week. And you know, as I open the hearing, I'll be glad to do that, because you know, I genuinely believe it, and you know, we'll be working with my counterpart on the other side that we in this Congress, you know, try and get some things done that will continue to move us in the right direction.
Great, thank you. And I did meet you once when you were in the House, and was very impressed and appreciated the time you gave me. And I wish you well. Thank you very much.
No, thank you so much, and thank you for calling. And again, you know, great comments. We're going to do one more call because we're running out of time, but the caller really makes a good point. You know, we do need regulation. There's no ifs, ands, or buts. The key is, you know, basing it on sound science, and we also can be very, very proud of the, you know, the tremendous gains that we've made through the years. But we can't just, you know, we can't do the unfunded mandates. We've got to work with our states, with our communities, working together. And there's lots of examples in Arkansas that's been done. And, you know, continue to move us in the right direction. Okay, let's go to our last caller. Are you there? Go ahead.
Am I on the line?
You're on the line. Yes, ma'am.
Okay, well, good deal. Well, I'm an elder writer, and I'm 87 years old, and I'm scared to death of our new dictator. I was alive during Mr. Hitler's rise, and Mr. Trump seems like another Hitler to me, and I'm sorry that I know you're Republican, and I'm praying for that man every day, because I want him to succeed. But he's doing everything he can to alienate people, and I just don't think that's wise. And I would like to know, What would it take to impeach him?
Well, he's only been in office for, you know, probably 40 or 50
days. Oh, I know,
days,
but,
so.
But thank God. But what are we going to do 2 years from now when he's got people bombing us from all over the world?
Well, let's wait and see in the sense
no,
that...
No, I don't want to wait and see. I want to be bombed by a missile from North Korea.
I understand, and you don't want it, but the reality is that, you know, we had an election, and that's what America's all about. And in Arkansas, he got 61% of the vote, and Hillary got 31.
Yeah,
so
I know.
You know, the vast majority of Arkansans...
I know what it is, but I don't really think that... I don't believe very many people even knew what we were getting. I was very ready to give the man every chance. But honestly, he behaves bad. He's not good for us in the world.
Right. And then the other thing is, you know, he simply hasn't done anything that merits impeachment.
Well, I just think he's a disgrace, and I think he's just I just don't believe he's building our esteem in the world. I don't think he's on our side sometimes. I think he's in it for himself and for his oversized ego.
Sure.
And I don't believe he's on our side.
No. Well, I understand. And like I say, you know, we had an election and that's how it works. And he's going to be president for the next 4 years. And I hope, you know, we as a Congress work with him. And I'll tell you, I appreciate you praying for him. Nobody can do anything nicer than that. And, you know, we're a great nation. And I think that, you know, we have the opportunity to go forward
this last incident of complete distrust, where this man went to he's part of the investigation. And in fact, I'm not sure he's not the chairman, but anyway, he went to Trump and told him things that he had discovered before he even told his own community. So I don't see that people connected with him. You just simply cannot believe a word they say, and you can see with their activities, they're not hidden too well.
Well, again, like I say, there's things going on in the sense that we've got a couple of committees looking at problems, you know, with the Russian interference. So all of that's working through, but he wants. You know, just like you, and just like, you know, I understand that you're a Democrat, just, you know, that's great.
Well, I have voted for more Republican presidents than I've ever voted for Democrats, because I'm that old. I've seen 14 presidents, I think, in my life.
But I know that you know, want the country to do well, and we all want the country to do well, and so hopefully we can work together and get it done,
Well, I just
think
we're stuck with him.
Well, I think we're actually poised for a lot of growth in the economy, and
I haven't
seen
any evidence
certainty.
Of that. He does most of his business with China. I heard the other day he had 551 businesses in China, so I know he's interested in business, but I just don't know what he's going to do for us, and I just don't trust his associates.
Well, he hasn't. He hasn't acted like he's, you know, I mean, he's been pretty harsh with China in the sense of loss of jobs and things like that. So,
Well, I just don't think the man can be trusted, but there's not a thing that you and I can do about it. So I'm glad I got to tell somebody that would listen.
No,
so thank you.
I appreciate that.
And
I always listen
to you.
Too, well,
because,
I appreciate that. And like I say, nobody
You are
can
our
do.
Representative, and we're dependent on you to look out for us in South Arkansas.
Yeah. No, I understand. And I take that very, very seriously. And El Dorado is a great town and has this wonderful town square. And as you know, we have an office down there.
I do know. And listen, let's stop this and let me tell you something else. I'm talking about the school teachers. Did you know... talking about taking the smart people out and leaving the bad people in, that is not the fault of the children. That's the fault of their homes. They are so neglected. They are so not encouraged to want to learn.
Sure.
And so it's not that some kids are smarter than other kids. It's just that they have more advantages the white ones do, or and the black ones too. There's plenty of black ones that are smart as can be. But I have a lot of engagements with young people, young kids, because I got grandchildren and great-grandchildren. And they do not teach these kids how to count. They cannot. They don't know that 7 and 3 make 10 and 9 and 1 makes 10 and 2 and 8 makes 10. They're teaching those kids to count on their fingers.
Sure.
And I have never, I was raised in Texas, and we learned how to read by phonics. I can read almost anything in the world, and I can also count. And I can multiply, but they're not teaching these kids the multiplication tables.
No, you're pretty, like I say, you're pretty savvy. You need to write down all the things you've been doing through the years so I can start doing it so that I'll be in the great shape that you're in.
My daughter is a teacher. She teaches yeah. other teachers.
And they work awful hard. The other thing, you know, the other thing we can be so proud of is the example, you know, that Murphy Oil set by the challenge account. You know, where government can't do everything, and here a company that's basically said, hey, you know, we want to be helpful, and has really changed a lot of lives helping
incredible.
Out, you know, with college
and
stuff.
And I was wondering about Mr. Trump with all of his money. Why don't he do something like that? Why don't some of the other millionaires do something like that? We'd be dead as color bellies if we didn't have Murphy.
You're exactly right. But the bottom line is, you know, not only folks like that, but we all need to be doing a little bit better, you know, we certainly don't have the resources that they have, but you know, again, as you mentioned, you know, these are families that don't have any support or really lack of family. Very high, minority and youth unemployment, some mental health problems thrown in with that, some addiction problems, and you know, it's just it's a tough situation, but we can all be more helpful in that regard.
While we're talking about that, I had a mentally ill daughter, so I know all about that.
Sure.
But in El Dorado, we have group homes, and those things are so successful. And those kids live, those young people live happily, and they learn to live as a family, and they're decent citizens. And so I think there might ought to be more thinking about doing that. Now, some people will not. Some people that are just they're not stable enough to do that, but it might be a way to keep them out of jail.
No, I appreciate that. Thank you so much for calling.
Well, thank you.
Be sure when I'm in El Dorado, be sure and grab me, okay?
I may do that. Okay.
Yes,
thank you very much. Bye.
Thank you very much. And well, listen, that's going to wrap things up tonight. What I'd like for you to do is don't hang up. If you'll stay on, you'll have the opportunity to leave a message for me if we didn't get to you with a question or this or that, or if you're on the phone, again, you'll have the opportunity to leave a voicemail. So do that, and then we'll follow up, and myself, my staff will get back to you and make sure that that the comments that you leave, or if you've got a question. We mentioned earlier as we were talking about an individual, a veteran that was having some troubles. If you're having troubles with, you know, Social Security or veterans issues, Medicare, any of those things, be sure and let us know about that. We'll get back to you as to how we can jump on those problems. So thanks for taking the time for listening, and we just had a bunch of good calls tonight that hopefully, you know, helped a little bit by me being able to express myself, but certainly more importantly, just getting an idea of what's on people's mind and how we can solve some of the problems that our great country faces. So thank you very much. Bye-bye.